I think while it's difficult to do enterprise sales because there's a lot of touch points, it's heavy on the resources that you need to put into the process. You have a very direct line of communication with the customer, so it's easy to ask the question why. When you're doing a B2C product, you have to find a way to collect the feedback from the users to understand why they're not, why it's not working out, why your messaging, your of value proposition is not being recognized. It's easier. This part's easier. There's a lot of stuff that's more difficult, but this part's easier in enterprise sales process because you actually get to talk to the customer in person, whether it's Zoom, but you have them in front of you, and you get to hear the no, and you get the to ask the questions why. Mm-hmm. And also, once you hear a no, once you have a no, they're much more honest about what they really want. Once you earlier in the process. It's much more difficult to understand what of the requirements and the needs that they share with you are really honest. Once they've decided that their product doesn't fit, they're actually much more honest about what really isn't working out.
Hello, Recursive community, and welcome back to our podcast series. Our next guest started his first startup venture at the age of 17. By the time he finished school, he managed to sell the business and return his investment. Since then, Orlin Radev has been a serial entrepreneur, a mentor, and a supporter of the Bulgarian tech ecosystem. Most recently, he is one of the founders and the CEO of Ampeco, the all-in-one electric vehicle charging management platform essential for the electric mobility evolution. And the company just closed a Series A investment supported by BMW iVentures and LaunchHub Ventures to scale and conquer the North American e-mobility market. Orlin, I'm very happy that you're here.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here as well.
I would like to get the backstory of what happened to you over the years. And somehow, let's maybe go back to school.
Wow, that's far.
It is maybe a long ago in your head, but I think it is also the experience that shaped your entrepreneurial journey afterwards. So you started the company at the age of 17. How were you doing in school back then?
Well, to be honest, the reason I saw the company was so that I can finish high school. Because you know stories about entrepreneurs dropping from college, but you haven't heard anyone dropping from high school, right? And having any success.
Okay.
So yeah,
what was the business about, and how did it evolve, and how did you sell it so fast? Yeah,
it was ISP, which is an internet service provider. Mm. So it was about making sure that people get broadband internet to their homes, which was at this point was a novelty. And it was inspired by my own desire to have broadband internet, and I wanted to also share this with everyone I can. Mm-hmm. So we started it together with my co-founder, who's also our current CTO. So we've been together for a long time.
Wow.
And we didn't anticipate that it would be successful. Actually, it wasn't surprising because we had a very good proposition for our customers. But we didn't expect that it will happen so quickly in a matter of months, because it actually took us 9 months from start to the moment we sold it. And the reason we sold it is that we thought initially we would be able to do this mostly during the spring, the summer, and then slow down when I have to get back to school. But there was no slowing down. So we found a company that actually can take over and continue what we started.
How old was your co-founder back then?
He was 3-4 years older than me. So okay. At least he has he could head a company legally, because I wasn't able to do so. I was still in high school at 17.
So that would have been one question. And the second one would have been, even if he was a bit older, I mean, you obviously didn't have a lot of business experience and acumen. I mean, did you start hiring people at some point? How did you manage the whole invoicing part? You know, it's not, and I can imagine back in the years, it was even more complicated than it is now today.
Well, there was a little bit of support from my family. Okay. My mother had a company, so had some idea, although she's definitely not the entrepreneurial type, but she knew something about the administrative part.
Okay.
On the business side, I mean, it was we had to learn as we go. We started with a business plan, though. So we had an idea about pricing and profit margins and so on. So this was mostly just talking to people who had some experience in the area. Mm-hmm. It was obviously a stretch for us at that time to know what we're doing. But I think we had a very strong drive. We wanted to do this, and we just found a way to onboard other people and to get them to help us. Some as part-time employees, because it was mostly us two full-time and a couple of friends part-time. Some as more of a help us get any understanding on how do we invoice and bill people, and what do we do about collecting payments and so on. Mm-hmm. So it was... It was something that required others to help us, but we were the ones with the energy and enthusiasm to get it running.
Did you have employees who were older than you? How would they look, you know, at someone who is their boss is 17?
No, it was mostly friends. I mean, it was friends as a summer job, so it wasn't that hard. We mm-hmm. didn't come to a point where we had to hire some professionals that were older than us. It would have been awkward.
Okay. And then you sold the company, and I wonder, okay, and then you finished school.
Yeah, I did finish school, by
you
the way.
You did,
yeah.
Okay. What was the key takeaway from this experience, you know, as an entrepreneur for you?
Mostly on a personal level, it was that I want to do more of this.
Wow.
That was
you got hooked.
Yeah, I got hooked for sure. So I knew that I like the fact that I'm in control of, to be honest, to be in control in your own destiny. I mean, because this is, you're not just working for someone else, you're crafting your own destiny. And this is something that I really liked. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I liked is how you put innovation and into a business, how you create an innovation and transform it into a business. This part has always stayed with me. And this is what has driven my desire to start and to start new companies over the years. And as a takeaways, well, one thing that stayed with me was you should always have a business plan, because I had a very rough one, but I did have one.
You did have a business plan?
Yeah, it was mostly a financial model, but as far as 17-year-olds go, I had a decent one. I knew what I was going to spend on. I knew how we were going to make money. And I think this gives you not only a peace of mind, but a framework that you can use to know if you're doing things right or not mm-hmm. as a business. And I use this with my next ventures after that.
Mm-hmm. So in the meanwhile, you can call yourself a proud serial entrepreneur, yeah?
I would say I'm a serial try different things kind of person.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Some of the ventures that you worked on worked out?
Some worked out.
Most didn't. Yeah. Or some didn't. I would have said some. How did you know when it's time to move on and to test, the opportunity of a new idea? I think this is the hardest part.
Yeah, I think
especially when you feel hooked in a business.
It's very hard because you can confuse your passion and enthusiasm for the potential of the business. And it's difficult to tell this apart. Mm-hmm. And also when you're behind the wheel and you're so enthusiastic about what you're doing, you can't really easily recognize if you hit like a roadblock or the end of the road. Mm-hmm. And I'm guilty of not recognizing this in some of my endeavors for sure, because I think I've pushed too far when things just were already clear that they're not working out. One of the things is you have to have a way to back away and look from a side, because you're obviously very involved when you're the one that started the business. You have the passion and you have the resolve you're willing to go when there's difficulties, but you have to be able to step back and see, is there a potential for this to actually happen, or am I just prolonging inevitable and
wishful thinking. Huh?
Yeah.
How do you have a technique for that? How do you do that?
I think having someone with you who can challenge you on mm-hmm. this and even disagree helps, because you serve to each other as a kind of
Sparring part.
Yeah, sparring partner, someone that can actually give you a different perspective. The other thing is also having to present your business and to defend it to other financiers, whether it's VCs or whoever's helping you fund, or partners that have to put in something else, but they have to believe that this would be a successful venture. Because when you have to defend and to explain how this business would happen, then your challenge, and you must think about it, and you must take the time and actually evaluate it. And this helps a lot. Because otherwise, in the day-to-day, with your passion and your enthusiasm about business, you're too much involved, and you have a perspective that's not necessarily objective.
What do you think is the most important quality of an entrepreneur? Or what is your superpower as an entrepreneur? Have you reflected on that?
Yeah, I have. And to be honest, I don't think I have any superpower as an entrepreneur. I think it's a combination of many things, and whatever you're lacking, finding a way to extend and to compensate with people around you. But things that obviously matter: resolve and willingness to push through when it makes sense to do so, and a strong conviction, the ability to form a strong conviction, because it's easy to say follow your passion, but it's about when things are not really going well, you should be able to create resolve and to condition yourself to have a strong conviction in what you're doing. And I think this makes it easier for others to follow you. And as an entrepreneur, you're not doing things alone. Whether it's your co-founders and then your first employees and then the wider group of people that join your company, they have to be able to follow you and to have the same conviction. And for you to inspire that, you have to be able to lead by example and to really have it and to show this strong conviction to succeed.
When you say strong conviction, and I mean, I was thinking in the beginning, it's kind of easy. You know, everyone is hyped up. Everyone is, yeah, we're going to do it. We're going to conquer the world. We're going to shoot for the moon. But the problem is when the first big challenges come, then it's a big test to how strong is your conviction. So how do you recognize that from the beginning, especially when you pick your team, when you pick your co-founders and partners in the venture?
I think it starts with what you want to achieve and having a clear idea of where you want to be if you succeed. So it's first of all in the goal setting maybe, and then being able to communicate and get to have a feeling that the people that you start working with, they understand and they actually want to achieve the same goal. And then it's about creating the milestones, and when you're failing, when you hit a challenge, you should know, is this something that we need to overcome to our next milestone? Did we hit such a milestone? Where are we behind? Are we ahead? So having these smaller steps and milestones that guide you to give you an idea if you're successful or not, or if you're really failing. And when others around you also know what these are, it's also easier for them to be reassured that, okay, this is actually a rough patch, but we are on the right path.
Okay. You mentioned also inspiring others to, you know, sustain their conviction, lead by example, show your strong conviction. How do you do that?
I don't know. To be honest, I think it's easier to look from a site and see what people are doing right in that than actually knowing what you're doing right. What I try is I try to be open and honest, and I try to communicate well why we're doing this and why this is important and what we want to achieve. And the rest is, I think, just leading by example and having people recognize that what you're doing is worthwhile, and then also knowing that what they're doing is worthwhile. But I don't have a formula for this, or I've reflected on this, and to be honest, I still don't know the answer.
Mm. Yeah, sometimes it feels that being a CEO is more like a CRO, like chief repetition officer, because you're kind of, you know, repeating the same things, reminding people, okay, this is the vision, that's the mission that we have, this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing the whole thing, this is why we need to go through that hard patch right now and still be optimistic about the future. Sometimes it's, it's easy for the leadership to have these perspectives, but it's not so easy when they are the people who are a bit more involved in their special project. So, you know, repeating this kind of like a big vision, I think it's essential part. I don't know. How do you feel about that? I find it, but we just spoke about it like 2 months ago, you know, it's team building. We had it.
Yeah, to be honest, every all hands meeting, it has the mission statement and the vision statement is being repeated. And it's like, it's not there for, it's not formality. It's a constant reminder that you need to reiterate and make sure that everyone's behind this. And yes, there is a lot of repetition of all of this, just reassuring that we are doing this. This is our mission. This is our vision. So this, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I didn't think about it in that way, but all hands meeting starts with the mission and vision. So I think it's exactly in that direction.
Mm, okay, so I hear it lately as a best practice example, by the way, that you know, the good CEOs, they do start.
Yeah, probably I saw it from someone else, from a good CEO, I guess.
Yeah, I think you actually learned to do a lot of the things intuitively because you were doing it hands on and you were just seeing what is working, what is not working, what is working, and still. It's impressive how reflected you are on the craftsmanship of entrepreneurship and also leadership.
I think empathy is important. I mean, I'm trying to figure out what works for me and to put my shoes in other people's, to put myself in other people's shoes. So I think this helps. If it works for me, maybe to work for others as well. So I'm trying to apply whatever I think is working, and I'm trying to empathize with whether it's employees, whether it's customers, also works for customers, I think. Just having being able to be very empathetic, this helps to figure out what to do. So it's intuition plus empathy, I think, helps a lot.
I have another question, and I'm sorry for, you know, being maybe so philosophical about these things, but because recently I had a conversation with a friend of mine, are you allowed to be disappointed as a CEO? You know, sometimes you see things are not working, you get also maybe pissed off at some people in the team or the whole team. You yourself are, you're a person too, you're allowed to have these emotions, but are you allowed to show them? Because we speak a lot about the inspiration, we speak a lot about the conviction and how do you kind of like ignite others to follow you. What about the negative emotions? Is it part of authentic leadership?
I think negative emotions, it's about honesty. You have to be honest intellectually, but you have to be honest emotionally as well. So just hiding everything that's negative, that creates a negative emotion, this creates, it's something that can be felt. So I think you should be cautious of whether this can be read the right way from the other side. It's easier with people who you've worked with for a longer time and you know each other and you know what this means. You have to be more careful when it's a wider audience and people may not know you as a person that well, and then it may be taken the wrong way.
Yeah.
But also I think you kind of have to be honest, even when there's negative emotion. Have to be at least to some degree be able to express this as well, and also to make sure that you accept what others are doing as well, and not take this as kind of negative emotion towards you, but be able to recognize that people do have negative emotions, even in a workplace environment, and even when it comes to the business. Again, have empathy for this. Just take it as honesty rather than something else.
I think this is why it's also very important to have a co-founder at Dampeco. It's the six of you. isn't that quite many for the, you know, average standard that we have in the industry?
For sure. I mean, that's if you're thinking about average standard, probably, yeah, it's too many. Yeah, yes. but uh, On the other hand, in our case, I think it's just the right number.
Okay.
I always work with a partner in all my startup endeavors. I work better when I have someone to challenge me and when I have someone to rely on, someone that can't fire me and I can't fire them, because this teaches you to compromise.
Okay.
And I think it's very important. And also teaches you to be more humble, because you have to consider someone else's opinions, an opinion that you can't really just ignore. On the other hand, when you think about leadership and management, you have to be clear about the roles and who's leading the company, who's leading what department, and so on. So I think in our case, we had this clear understanding from the beginning, and we've stuck to that. But just having people that you can lean on, that you know share the exact same responsibility, conviction as you do, it really gives you peace of mind, especially when things are not going well. And there'll always be, I mean, the startup is a roller coaster. There's always downs. And you need to be able to rely on people. I'm not saying you can't do this with employees, early employees, of course. But it has always worked better when I have partners to lean on.
How does it look when you don't agree, six people? Who is then taking decisions? How is this process actually working in your specific case? You have too many voices coming in? Yeah.
Well, there are things that everyone's involved, specifically on more strategic decisions on the future of the company. But then on the management, there's certain roles. I mean, we have our CTO who's responsible for technical decisions, myself more of about product and obviously strategic and high level management decisions. We have Stefan, who's our CRO, who's responsible for the business side. Our other three co-founders are technical, so they have more consulting role, not managerial role. And when I have an understanding of what the role is, it doesn't have to get confused with ownership. As co-founders, we share ownership. As roles in the company, we have different roles and we manage different aspects of it.
Do you manage to change the hats easily?
Yeah.
I think shareholders and on the others is...
I think we've managed so far.
Yeah.
There have been no conflicts in that on that front. And again, I'm not saying that this is a formula that you can replicate easily. I think it's something to be considered and to have... To be cautious about, and we knew that we are creating an unusual setup, so we were cautious about how we handle this in time.
Do you have some tips and tricks of what you've done? Like, I don't know, did you do some kind of like a personality assessment at some point, or a cultural assessment, or I don't know? Oh, did you have a coach?
Not really. Yeah. With many of our co-founders, we knew each other for years.
Yes.
With some of them, we've known each other from childhood. So it was, we knew what to expect. And we knew the personalities of each other. And it was nature on who takes what responsibility. It wouldn't work out the same way if you're just a group of people who, even if they share the same vision about the company, they just don't know each other that well. So probably then it would be much more about creating this culture. It's also just about culture, but just setting the boundaries, getting to know each other, and to understand what you can expect and how you can work together in this setup.
What I find interesting is that, okay, so we know the latest development of the story and your investment from BMW iVentures and LaunchUp. But what I found interesting is that your story with Empeco starts also with BMW.
Indeed it is. Indeed.
So you were on the road?
We
buying one.
We already had a thesis around what we want to do in e-mobility, but to get a stronger conviction and to also get a better understanding of the size and the type and the essence of the problem that we want to solve, we went to Germany and bought a BMW car, an i3, which is a car that at the time it was able to drive like 120 kilometers with one charge.
Mm-hmm.
And we drove it to Sofia. And we charged at 20 plus different locations over 35 hours.
Wow.
So it was quite the road trip. But it was meant to be like this.
Where did you buy it in Germany?
It was in northeastern Germany.
Northeastern,
so
okay.
Around 1,500 kilometers.
Oh, okay.
Quite a trip. It was.
1,500 for 35. It's still a lot.
Yeah, it's still a lot because you have to go to places to charge.
Wow.
Because I also quickly realized there is not enough, and there is not enough working charging infrastructure. So we faced. I think we concentrated the experience of every EV driver at that time in a 35 hours window. So it was a learning.
What was the year, by the way?
It was 2018. Summer of 2018.
Not so far.
I mean,
so
but
long ago.
To be honest, many drivers have a similar experience even today. I think the problems are yet to be solved, and there's a lot to be done in that direction. But for us, coming from a place that's definitely immobility was just a would it be, would it not be type of thing. We had to have had some firsthand learning and. To get into the shoes of our potential customer, their actual customer.
So it was a field study what you did back then, buying this.
Yeah, it was a very amateur field study. Yes.
Did you have any market research, like talking to other e-car drivers on the way?
We used every opportunity we had. Obviously, yeah. We also had mapped out the type of charging stations from different operators that mm-hmm. we wanted to use, just to see the different user experience. To see what software they're using, how the user experience is for the EV driver. So this was obviously a study, kind of study for us. But it was also an adventure, to be honest, because we were not sure that we were going to find the next one and to be able to get home without any issues. So it was a lot of fun. We actually have a video of this. That at some point we're probably going to share.
You should. Please do. We will be happy to host it on the recursive. Wow. Okay. So you clearly saw that there is an issue.
Yeah, I think we, as an entrepreneur, you should aim to solve big problems. Ones that either touch a lot of people. Definitely ones that when you think about your solution, the market would be big enough. If you had the ambition to create a big company, then you have to be solving big problems. And we were still at that point not so sure about the severity of the problem. And this trip helped us get a clearer understanding of how big the problem is. And as a consumer, as the EV driver, as the one that's driving the car and has to use the EV charging networks, we realized that the problem is big enough. And we realized this would be something that's touching at some point when we eventually transition to electric vehicles, it would be touching almost everyone. It would be something that almost everyone have to deal, almost every business would have to deal. A lot of the business that have parking spaces would have to deal with this. So we were still wondering, is this a very niche thing? Or is this something that actually is quite significant, quite big? And we realized it's going to be a big thing. It's going to be something that on the surface it sounds as a niche thing, but when you think about what it would be 10, 15 years in the future, it would be something that relates to everyone's life and to every business.
Mm-hmm. I think it was still hard probably back then, although you got a grasp of the severity of the problem and how even more severe it would become if we don't provide the necessary solutions. I still think that it was challenging to think of the solution that would be working because there are so many approaches that you can actually take. How did you think about the solution back then and did it change over time?
Yeah, at this point, we had no idea what the solution is. We only knew there was definitely a big enough problem.
Yeah.
We came up with the solution and with our first iteration of our solution or our first hypothesis about the solution a couple of months later. But in reality, we really It really crystallized over a time of almost a year when we got to really explore the industry. We started the company. We knew what our MVP would be, what our initial product would be. But it was not. We knew it was not the final thing. We knew that we need to learn. We need to become from outsiders to the industry. We need to become insiders from people who've just experienced as a user the problems. We had to become the experts. So first year is was mostly about it.
We went, so none of you had experience in the industry before that?
No, none of us had any experience in the immobility before that. To be honest, the good thing is, very few people had anyway.
True.
So,
true. But it's still very brave. Wow. Okay.
And very naive, which is another quality that probably an entrepreneur should have. Naivety, yes. I think, is a very important quality.
Well, let's call it optimism. Okay. Yeah, you shouldn't be aware of what you're actually really getting yourself into.
No, I mean, if I knew everything else, everything that I know today, and with this knowledge, I'm going back. I'm not sure it will help me. It may actually hinder it and even make me probably doubt if we even have to do this.
I think I'm going to do a poll at some point, you know, amongst founders who have been in the business for at least 3 years. So if you knew how it's going to be, would you have done it? I fear the answers but and the results of the poll. But yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon. Okay. So you're outsiders of the industry and you decided that you're going to gain the insight hands-on by working on it, right? Or did you did you follow any kind of methodology? I mean,
the first thing is it was a lot of discovery. So we made sure that we went to all events that had to do with the industry. So immobility events, energy related events, automotive events. So we went to meet the people who actually have some experience. Mm-hmm. And to get knowledge and to get their experiences and to learn from them. Okay. And quickly apply this in what we were creating as a product. We obviously had a thesis around the first type of customers that would use it and what kind of problems we'll solve for them. But it evolved as our learnings and understanding of the sector and of the challenges and problems also increased in time. So it was a lot of meetings, a lot of learnings, a lot of travel also. And to be honest, we were happy this was happening in 2019, because if we started a year later, we wouldn't be able to make this type of very proactive, a lot of travel and so on.
Were you still using the BMW to travel?
Or? Oh, no, no. To be honest, we were using a very unpleasant and unsustainable way of travel by plane, mostly.
Okay. And then it all stopped. Pandemic came. COVID came.
Yeah, COVID came. For this was we already just had our product out and signed with a few customers. And now we were ready to fundraise to really get this going.
But people were staying at home. They weren't very mobile. So the prospect of, you know, growing an immobility company at this point wasn't probably very, I mean, it was very unclear because we didn't have the vaccines. We didn't know how long it would take.
Yeah,
it
definitely wasn't the best time to fundraise for us or for anyone that had to be involved in building up infrastructure for vehicles. So yeah, it was a very bad timing in that regard, but there was also some positive outcomes of the lockdowns for us. It sped up the conversations. Previously, we had to mostly do in person meetings because it's a very enterprise heavy sales process. We are selling a software solution that companies use as a business critical solution. And the type of companies that would buy it, they're usually corporations.
Yes.
And the process is quite lengthy with a lot of touch points and previously with a lot of in-person meetings as well. But then everyone, and us being based in Bulgaria against competitors being based where the customers are based, didn't help. But then with the lockdowns, it allowed us to be on a more leveled ground with the competition.
Mm-hmm.
And also it allowed us to do many more meetings. Now you were able to do video calls like 7-8 meetings in a day, which is unthinkable before, which is just acted as an accelerator for the sales and for the business development, but even for the learning, where you had to get to meet potential partners or people just to learn from. You were able to feed those many more of those in a day than previously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of an accelerator as well. There was this strange dynamics where business stopped, meaning that everyone's cautious. We can't go and install charging stations, so we wouldn't buy the software now. But at the same time, meetings were happening very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, this eventually turned out to be quite important for our success, because this was the time during COVID when we grew, when we really accelerated.
Excuse me for the question, but did you face any prejudice? Like, I mean, now these Bulgarians are offering me this solution for my immobility park. Isn't it easier if you're German? I don't know, if you're coming from a country that has a bit better traditions in green technologies and green economy and sustainability, because we don't have the ecosystem for neither.
Yeah, to some degree. But also, we were not selling them green technologies, we were selling them software.
Okay.
And we kind of have a good...
I see.
I think it was easier for us that there was just a software company, there was nothing else now.
Mm-hmm.
But there was prejudice from the fact that, I mean, just more towards the stage of the development of the company, being a very early stage startup, whether you're based in Bulgaria or based anywhere, just the lack of credibility, the certainty about your future, because we want them to buy a software solution that's going to be business critical for their, and for years they will rely on it to run their business. But we have no credibility and no clear future ahead of us. We are a pretty much bootstrapped startup. So we may not be on the market in a year. So this was the toughest thing. And I think our first customers, they had a certain level of naivety as well to go with us.
Thank you, first customers.
Yes, thank you, first customers. It was amazing that you were so naive to go with us.
Yeah. What I find also interesting that you actually bootstrapped. How long was that?
We got our first external funding. We had an angel investment.
Yeah, true.
Didn't really fully bootstrap. We had 240,000 euro angel investment, which for an angel investment for a startup sounds like quite a significant one. For a company that has to develop an enterprise software solution, it's absolutely not enough. I mean, it's even with the fact that we were mostly the co-founders in the beginning, and so we definitely were cutting on saving on our own salaries. Yeah, just the fact we had to travel a lot.
It was definitely not much. No.
No, it was not much.
Yeah.
And it got us to, and we got our first funding in 2022.
Yes.
The seed investment we received in April 2022. And so from December in 2018 until April 22, we are mostly managing on the income from customers.
Mm-hmm. And business in investment is not necessarily giving you the credibility that you need. I mean, having an institutional investor is usually related to a much deeper due diligence, and it's a bit more structured process. So it is also the signal that you could give to customers, okay, these guys, they really have...
Yes, that's true.
This
was one of the reasons we wanted to get an institutional investor earlier on in 2020 and 2019. But then with COVID, we were just off the table.
Yeah.
So this was the time when we really had to bootstrap. Because this is the time that, as far as angel investment goes, this is where it got us to.
Mm-hmm.
But then from 2020 to 2022, it was month by month, making sure that you sell enough to be able to pay the salaries next month. But it's also the time when we grew from like 12 people to 45 people.
Wow.
So it was a constant race. Where you're trying to expand, and every month you're expanding your income, while at the same time you're spending more every month because you want to also grow the team and spend more on marketing and so on.
We all know this kind of problem. But I wanted to bring you to another aspect of the art of making the business case of Ampeco. So you are developing an enterprise solution, and the product market fit for, or the process of getting product market fit looks a bit different there. So you mentioned that your first customers were obviously optimistic enough. So although you didn't have so much on the table, they decided to work with you. But did you structure it in some way so that you gain the insight that you need to position yourselves afterwards in a more competitive way than all the others in your industry?
Yeah, what really won us our first customers was the product. So they had to make a compromise on everything else, from the credibility of the company to the uncertainty of relying on a provider that obviously they have no idea if we're going to exist next year. But what they really wanted was the product. So to be able to get to this point, this is where the learning, what I mentioned, and just making a lot of effort to understand the market and what the problems are, and to map this out and create a product that really addresses those. Obviously, as when you're building a product that's so heavy, an enterprise software solution, you have to find a way to narrow down to the way we did it, we focused on a certain group of customers. And we made sure that we knew that we would be expanding to others, but we made sure that initially for this group of customers, the product really is really valuable for them. And
how did
the
you
way
make sure that? I mean, did you
we asked them?
You just did it without selling, without just.
Oh, we were trying to sell them and asking at the same time.
And they were saying no.
Yeah, a lot of no's. That's what you should expect. You shouldn't expect that people just jump to buy your product. You get a lot of no's, but it's important to understand why. Why is this a no? Yeah. And then you use this either to iterate in the product or to iterate in the sales process. Mm-hmm. And then you get another no with another why, and you get some other input and you implement this. And when you do this enough times, you start getting maybes.
I see. Okay, so, there is a progress.
There's progress, definitely.
Nice. So a lot of no's, and then you ask always why. I think this is very important here because I think, you know, just talking to my sales colleagues sometimes, and they're frustrated when they get a no or when the customer is, you know, prolonging the whole negotiation process. And don't worry about it. I mean, this is just part of it. You're going to get used to that. But it's more important to understand why, because every no is a potential maybe. And then from maybe you get to yes. And I've experienced that so many times. But you have to keep the conversation going.
Yes, and I think while it's difficult to do enterprise sales because there's a lot of touch points, it's heavy on the resources that you need to put into the process, you have a very direct line of communication with the customer. So it's easy to ask the question why. When you're doing a B2C product, you have to find a way to collect the feedback from the users to understand why it's not working out, why your messaging, your of value proposition is not being recognized. It's easier. This part's easier. There's a lot of stuff that's more difficult, but this part's easier in enterprise sales process because you actually get to talk to the customer in person, whether it's Zoom, but you have them in front of you, and you get to hear the no, and you get to ask the questions why. Mm-hmm. And also, once you hear a no, once you have a no, they're much more honest about what they really want. Once you, earlier in the process, it's much more difficult to understand what of the requirements and the needs that they share with you are really honest. Once they've decided that their product doesn't fit, they're actually much more honest about what really isn't working out.
Mm-hmm. Well, you find also the time to support other founders in the process, and you're an active mentor. Tell me, why is this, in your opinion, important? And why is it important for you? I mean, I guess you're busy enough and you've been going through obviously also some difficult patches where you had to bootstrap the whole thing. You were cutting your salaries. There wasn't much funding. You were still working on the product and so on and so forth. Why would you find the time to be a mentor and spend, you know, time looking into other people's businesses?
Mostly because I've had others take their time to do this for me.
Okay.
And I've used this and it has helped me.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think I should be giving it back. But also because part of what I want to achieve and as an entrepreneur is impact. And it goes from one way you do the one way achieve the impact is through the essence of your business. So what we're doing on its own, it goes towards having a certain impact. But the fact that we're doing this from Bulgaria, we're doing this in a challenging, I would say, sector as well. The impact that we want to have is also on the local ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want this to delay this and to postpone this to a certain time in the future when I have more time. Along the way, I want to be able to contribute and have this impact as well.
I find it very curious, especially in a trusted environment that we are often together in Power of BG, how important it is to talk to peers who are in a similar situation like you, because even if you have the co-founders, even if you have your employees, there are certain things that you don't want to discuss with them because it is partially a personal growth that needs to happen. Yeah. I remember at some point I was in a situation where my co-founder and I, we were not in this company, but in another company, we were doing a bit of coaching. And then the coach said, well, we're touching at issues that we cannot solve together here. You need to go to your coach and you need to go to another coach. But it is affecting the way that you work. So there is this personal growth happening. And I find it curious how do you build this kind of like a trusted environment so that you can speak honestly about things? Because the success stories, they're super impressive. And I'm sure right now that there are many who are celebrating your latest success. But how do we get back to the honest conversation where we speak about the failures, where we speak about the challenges that we have in an honest way? I think this is critical.
Tough question.
Mm.
But for me, it's been easy for me to be honest because I don't think I value or I get hurt by people that I don't really value their opinion. So when I do have someone in front of me that I value as a person and they have other opinion, I don't mind being honest and sharing, and then getting feedback, and I appreciate it.
Even if it's harsh.
Yeah, I mean, harsh is what you want. I mean, just congratulations on your success doesn't really help you grow as a person or do any personal development. harsh is what really gets you, moves you forward. And you should be able to take it in a way that you realize I'm not being hurt, I'm being helped, which is, I think, is more of a your personal attitude towards feedback and generally, I mean, some other people's opinions and input.
Do you think it's a critical quality of the entrepreneur to be able to digest feedback, even if it's hard? You know, I see sometimes first-time founders, and they come, they pitch to you, but some of them would never listen. And I'm thinking, this is a big mistake that you're doing right now. Yeah.
Yes, I think it's a moment that you can use for learning, even if you disregard it. But this is something that usually you would have to chase and find a way to get out of people. So feedback, how you use it is up to you. But having it is valuable. So this is something that you get some value. Whether you use it and how you use it, that's up to you. One thing you shouldn't do is take this personally, because then you're closing off. When you close, when you just close off, you're not listening. You're not thinking how this can help me. The way I look at it, how can this help me? Even if the intention isn't great, to be honest, this may still be something that actually can help me. So I would look at it from the perspective of being valuable for me, and using this to improve or just to even validate something that I'm not agreeing with.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way I think you should look at it. And when you look at it that way, it's something that's a value that you're receiving. It's useful.
Did you have your own mentors over the years? You mentioned that you received a lot of feedback, and this is your way of giving back to the ecosystem. Who are the people that accompanied your development as an entrepreneur?
I've had different people influence my understanding in different topics, not only business related, but also on personal level. I haven't had a mentor per se, but I've always tried to be proactively learning from people and asking questions and using their answers to form my own opinions and understandings. And this has helped me a lot, even if it wasn't a traditional mentor-like relationship.
Mm-hmm. Okay, coming back to Ampeco, I wanted to ask you a bit more about what is happening right now. So you got the investment. What I find interesting is that you first explored the European markets and the UK, but now with the investment, your target will be the US. Can you maybe share a bit about the differences between the markets? And
it will be very pragmatic about what are the markets we go after. We went for the UK for the fact that it's a big enough market that's easier to penetrate, meaning that there is the language barrier on the one hand. It's easier to have people that are fluent in English out of Bulgaria. But also it was a market that was more open and a little bit behind than, for example, Germany, which was the market that otherwise we could have gone to.
Mm-hmm.
So we liked this fact that it is a less competitive market that has to catch up. So we thought this is the right time for us to go to this market.
Mm-hmm.
And then once we had significant traction in the UK, next one for us was, well, what are the markets where it's most difficult and which are most advanced? And this was the Nordics and Netherlands. So this was the next focus was on these markets, because then we get to actually validate if it's working in it was working in the UK, but maybe because also the maturity of the market wasn't at the same stage. But then when you do it in the market where it's most difficult, then you know that you found the product market fit.
Mm.
And from that point on, it's about just thinking in terms of what are the biggest opportunities for growth, where we can develop the quickest. The US market is our next frontier for the fact that it's eventually going to be the biggest market. This is why we're going there. We weren't ready to do this without the latest investments, just because it's more expensive to set up there.
I was just about to ask you if you decided that the US market is going to be your next target or frontier before you decided to fundraise, and you were looking specifically for an investor who can actually help you launch there, or was it something that evolved in the fundraising process? I mean, you mentioned that you spoke to how many? To 70?
70 VCs. This
VCs.
Is we spoke to 70 VCs, and with a lot of those, we didn't just have an intro. We had several touch points, and it was quite a rigorous process. But we knew that we are fundraising actually for the US expansion.
Okay.
With the previous funding that we got, we wanted to dip our toes, so to say, and hire first two people in the US. But this happened early last year. And since then, the climate changed. it was clear that we would have to have a more extended runway to be more cautious, because maybe the next fundraising could be more difficult, which made us also reconsider, can we really spend the money now to hire people in the US, which would definitely shorten our runway. So it was a decision to postpone the expansion to the US, but at the same time, we knew that this was an opportunity that we want to chase. So we decided to fundraise quite quickly after the seed round, same year, in fact, just so that we have really the funding to be not only to go to the US, but be quite aggressive in our US expansion.
And BMW Ventures, they're in a way also a strategic investor, right? How is it a typical corporate VC structure, or how does it work? Why did you decide to go with them in the first place?
They're not a typical corporate VC. They're not looking for strategic synergy between their single LP, who's BMW Group, and the companies they invest in. They are typical technology VC, where they invest in technology companies. They've had previous investors in companies that work in the EV charging sector, which gave them a good understanding of the market. And for us also, it was important, and they had such in the US, and gave us also the indication that they would know what it means to work in this sector, and they know the specifics of the sector, which was a great benefit for us. Not so much the connection with BMW Group. So that's the main reason, actually, we chose them. And the other thing is, we like the fact that it's a Silicon Valley-based VC with very strong connections in the US, in the VC space, I mean, but also generally in the business connections. So these are reasons that some of the reasons that that played a significant role for us to choose BMW Ventures. And for them, I think the understanding of the sector, they were very well positioned to recognize the potential of the company. That's and so to create on their part a very strong conviction for the investment case.
Okay, but their brand helps.
Oh, the brand helps a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's recognizable, which works out well for credibility in front of customers and partners, to just the visibility that you get when you announce, and generally the association helps a lot. But this is more about on the front of credibility and marketing rather than any business synergies that we're necessarily getting or looking for.
I see. Wow, interesting. Did you tell them the story about the BMW that you bought in Germany still?
Yes, I did, actually.
Did it help in the fundraising process?
I don't think it played any role. only maybe just to break the as a topic that would help us be more open in the communication. But otherwise, it was a fun story. Nothing more than that.
How did you still convince them? It was the product again.
It was the business. It was difficult, by the way. It was not an easy thing.
Series A is much more difficult than C, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, it's things that helped for sure are the KPIs and what the business is at the moment. So we already have amazing growth, but not just growth. All across, we have amazing KPIs. As a business, we are a very good business, and this helped with others as well. I think the thing that was mostly most difficult to convey and to get the same conviction from the VCs, not BMW Ventures, but also others we talked to, was the size of the market and what will happen in this market. Because all of the assumptions are the things that are going to happen in the future. It's not a market that's already clear to understand. You have to make a lot of assumptions of what's going to happen and what role we can play in this space.
How competitive it is right now?
On the surface, the market, very competitive. Okay. meaning that there's a lot of companies who are doing software management in EV charging. When you start digging, you understand that the ones that sit on a fundamental level that we do are very few. Mm-hmm. We are most often competing against a couple of other companies on deals.
Yeah, I was just thinking that for me, as someone who is not part of the industry, it's very hard to assess that because it's all software and it's all EV charging stations, but how, I don't really understand who is doing really what.
I think for VCs, to be honest, they have an amazingly difficult job because they have to get into the details and to deep understanding about so different types of companies. And I think this was also the biggest challenge during our fundraising, because everyone wanted to talk to us when they see our pitch deck and see how we're doing. But then getting a strong conviction around the future of the EV charging space and what role we play, this is where they had a problem to form their strong opinion that matches mm-hmm. what we were saying and trying to convey.
So you hooked them with the good numbers.
Oh yeah,
business performance, and then you explain to them what are you really doing.
That's exactly how it works.
Nice, very good marketing approach. Okay, because I think a lot of companies actually try to do the opposite.
No, I mean you have to have the good numbers to be able to do this. I had a conversation with an English VC, second call we're having, and he's still looking at me and saying, I understand you're doing very well something, I still don't understand what it is that you're doing so well, why. And to be honest, this is the kind of feedback that you should be able to get and actually reflect on this and find a way, because obviously I was not doing my job very well. Okay. in conveying what it is in essence that we do so well and that would is the reason that we are going to be successful in the future as well. Mm-hmm. But it's not obvious. And when you're, especially in a space that's so specific and there's no general knowledge about it, the gap between my understanding of the space and the VC's understanding of the space is quite significant. And the challenge is, how do I bridge this gap and bring them up to speed to what I understand and what I see so that they can see the same thing? This was the hardest thing during our fundraising. I think we didn't do a great job after all, because this is where things broke during our fundraising process. We were not able to convey, because you have to do it also in a very concise way. You have several meetings where you should be able to create this to bridge this gap. And with many of the VCs, this is where they were just not being able to understand and get to the same view that we have.
And what I find infuriating also with VCs is that, okay, they tell you maybe a no, but when you ask them why, you don't really always get an honest answer, because they don't want to close the door.
Yeah, VCs is one type of customer, so to say, because you're kind of selling. Where after the no, you don't get the honest answer.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Always, almost, I mean, a typical answer, well, it's too much of an execution game, which is true for any business. Obviously, execution is or we can't get a conviction on the market. There are specific things that which doesn't close the door. I mean, next fundraising, you're executing well, let's talk again. Or by next year, we get a better understanding of the markets, let's talk again. Often, they would not really give you the honest feedback that's really helpful. And you should still strive to get it, because it's you're in a process. What you can learn from the no's can be applied with the next conversations. So you can still try, and you should still try to get to the bottom of the no, but often it's not really possible.
Yes. Well, so 70 is still kind of like manageable. I mean, we know our founders, especially from our region, who talk to hundreds of them, and they would still receive so many no's. And I hope that one day when you get to the point where you feel like you've done a really successful job with your company, you would be able to talk to some of those who said no to you. Talk to them again. By the way, what is the big vision? I mean, when we measure success, we speak of numbers, but I think it's also very important to have a picture of how success looks like. So do you have a vision like that in your head or maybe within your team?
Yeah, in my vision, it's a market share. Yeah. So a dominant player in our space with significant market share, I'm talking 25-30%, mm-hmm. That's the vision. And it's a bold one, to be honest, because we're talking also worldwide, but also this is, you have to be bold on your vision. It's also at the same time achievable. So it's just several, if not quite a lot, milestones until we get there, but it's achievable. It's something we can do. Mm-hmm. And that's what we want to achieve.
And what are you going to do then? How are you going to kind of celebrate it? Do you have it in your head?
I've never been...
You see the number, okay, you're getting to the 30-40%. Okay, let's say it's 36% right now. What are you going to do?
Even before that, I would have set another goal that's more ambitious.
So it's never enough.
Oh, no, there's okay. No end game. I mean, it's not yeah. Something that you win. It's a constant race mm-hmm. without a finish line. So it's just a game that you want to play as long as you can.
Do you enjoy playing the game?
I enjoy playing the game a lot.
Nice. Thank you, Erlin. It was a very great and honest conversation.
Thank you so much.
These are the ones that I actually enjoy. We can speak about the real thing and not only about the version that we put in the press releases.
Indeed. And these are also the ones that I like as well.
Next on the Recursive Podcast, we meet with Ned Dervenkov, the CEO of the Bulgarian Startup Association, BESCO.
And in this knowledge-intensive industry, human capital is by far the most important thing. You know, money is a resource that you can source locally or you can source, you know, from abroad. Yep, maybe it's more difficult than in other countries, but if you have something good, you know, money is not a problem, usually. What is a problem is that if you have some great idea and, you know, you need doers and you need people with your values and, you know, the right knowledge and the right background and, you know, the right ambition, the right families, if you wish, that stuff, you know, collecting the right people is tough. And if I can do it, and if you can do it, there's no guarantee that people would be left for the third guy. And we need to make sure as an ecosystem that there are people for the third guy and the fourth guy and the 400th guy. So everyone with a good idea should be able to recruit great talent so that he can actually make this idea a world-class idea.
And if you're just as passionate about innovation as we are, hit subscribe for the Recursive Podcast on YouTube or your favorite podcast platform. We're everywhere.